Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the first female co-president of Pax Christi International speaks out about the challenges facing the organization today. Benedictines in the United States are leading the way in finding alternative sources of natural energy to help combat climate change. But first, Pope Benedict appeals for a peaceful solution to the crisis in northern Iraq as he greets pilgrims and visitors gathered for his Sunday Angelus address. Pope Benedict on Sunday spoke of the virtues of the 16th century Archbishop of Milan, St. Charles Borromeo, whose feast day falls on November the 4th.
Carlo Borromeo, Arcivescovo di Milano. La sua figura si staglia nel secolo XVI.
Recalling that his predecessor, Carol Wojtyła, marked this as his own feast day, Pope Benedict said the figure of St. Charles shines as a model of charity, prayer, and apostolic zeal, a man who gave his all in the service of others.
A rinunciare a se stesso per farsi servo di tutti.
In an appeal after the recitation of the Angelus prayer on Sunday, Pope Benedict also spoke of his concerns about the growing tensions between Turkey and Iraq, urging political leaders to find a peaceful solution to the problems there. My colleague Chris Altieri takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Proprio in considerazione del bene di quelle popolazioni che comprendono anche numerosi cristiani.
Speaking to thousands of pilgrims gathered to pray the Sunday Angelus in St. Peter's Square, Pope Benedict said the developments in the Turkey-Iraq border region are a source of concern for him and for all. The Holy Father encouraged every effort to reach a peaceful solution.
Auspico inoltre che le relazioni tra popolazioni migranti.
Pope Benedict also urged civil authorities to respect immigrants' rights. The Pope's appeal came as Italy struggles with public outrage over a series of violent crimes blamed on Romanian and other immigrants. After the Angelus prayer and his appeals, the Holy Father greeted pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I happily greet all the English-speaking pilgrims gathered for this Angelus. In today's liturgy, the Book of Wisdom tells us that the Lord has mercy on all, because he's a lover of souls. My dear friends, may God's word and your visit to his holy city inspire you to share Jesus' love and mercy to everyone you meet. I wish a joyous Sunday to all.
My thanks there to Chris Altieri for that report on Pope Benedict's appeal at his Angelus address. Global Peace Network, Pax Christi International, has concluded its General Assembly in Belgium with a visit to the town of Ypres and a tour of the First World War cemeteries, a poignant reminder of the devastation caused by conflicts over the past century. The Pax Christi movement was founded in France at the end of the Second World War by Catholics seeking to promote reconciliation and healing. It has grown into a worldwide faith-based network with over 100 member organisations involved in conflict resolution and justice and peace promotion. At the assembly, which concluded at the weekend, outgoing international president, Patriarch Michel Sabah of Jerusalem, handed over to two new co-presidents, Archbishop Laurent Monsengwo of the Democratic Republic of Congo and American laywoman Marie Dennis, formerly head of the Maryknoll Office for Global Concerns.
In each part of the movement, our work is expressed in different ways, but the common areas of major concern continue to include disarmament, peace building, all of the very kind of traditional work for peace, for a more peaceful world.
As delegates visited the First World War memorials on Friday, I talked to Marie Dennis about the challenges facing the organization today.
I think the greatest challenge is to turn, this is probably quite obvious, but it's to turn the world away from the variety of violences that now plague almost every corner of the world, whether it's the violence of war, of which we have much too much, the violence of street crime and local insecurities, the violence of poverty, the violence of torture. The list is very long, and the challenge for Pax Christi as a movement based in every corner of the world is to create a culture of peace, to literally find other ways and encourage people to move in other directions than the direction in which we're now headed.
Is this the first time that a woman has been elected president or co-president of the organization?
It is, yes. The initial founders of Pax Christi after the Second World War were a French woman and a bishop. But since then, the president of Pax Christi has always been a bishop or a cardinal. So this is the first time that a woman has been elected, and it's the first time that we've had co-presidents.
You're also a mother and a grandmother as well, aren't you? What particular gifts, what particular charism do you think you can really bring to the leadership of this organization?
I think what I bring comes very much out of that experience of being a mother and a grandmother, which is very deep roots in local communities. I believe that what I can bring to the movement is commitment to relationships, to building deep, right relationships in every direction in our world. And I think that comes very much from my own experience. I also have been part of the peace movement in the United States for probably 35 years. So I have a pretty long experience in working for peace that is rooted in social justice and increasingly in recent years, recognizing the connections between environmental destruction and the potential for violence.
You're also a secular Franciscan, aren't you? How much does St. Francis's vision of peace and justice and care for creation really inform all the work that you do?
Yes, I am a secular Franciscan, and the Franciscan direction in life has a tremendous impact on me. I am part of one of the founders of and a member of a small intentional community in Washington, D.C. in the United States called Assisi Community. Our community tries to implement, to interpret the way of Francis, which was the way of Jesus, in our own times. And so in every corner of my life, Francis and Claire have a major impact.
I know you've been arrested and jailed for demonstrating against poverty, against injustice. Do you see that perhaps today there's rather a lack of people willing to stand up for their faith and for their principles, whatever the consequences?
Well, there may be a lack, but there are also many, many people who are doing so every day. It doesn't always result in an arrest. In some ways, we have the privilege in the United States of being able to risk arrest with some safety. That's not true all over the world, but everywhere, in every corner, people are working, giving their lives for peace. And I often have an image of the sort of reality that given all of the work for peace at local levels where people are educating for peace all the way to those who are in prison for peace, that peace almost can't help but break out in the future because there is such a strong movement for peace in the world. On the other hand, that movement for peace is too often overwhelmed by powerful forces that are violent, and we need to keep struggling to overcome that.
Your meeting there in Belgium with representatives of national sections of Pax Christi all over the world, aren't you? And I'm just wondering if you can outline perhaps some of the major areas of concern that the organization will be focusing on in the coming years.
I can, yes. Yes, there are about, in addition to national sections, of which there are many around the world, we also have present at this gathering our partner organizations from all over the world. I think we're representing 50 different countries, so it's a wonderful gathering of wisdom and commitment. In each part of the movement, our work is expressed in different ways, but the common areas of major concern continue to include disarmament, peace building, all of the very kind of traditional work for peace, for a more peaceful world. We also are focusing increasingly on human security, realizing that the lack of attention to basic needs in many parts of the world often makes the work for peace more difficult. So poverty, trying to build a just economy, and so on are important components of peace building. We also are increasingly attentive to environmental destruction, to ecology, always through the lens of its impact on or how it results from violent conflict. So whether we're looking at the arms race itself or war itself, whether we're looking at poverty and economic issues, whether we're looking at environment, we're always doing so through the lens of violent conflict. How are situations worsened by conflict, by war, and how are they causing war? So our major lines of work will continue in about the same direction as they have been in the past. But we have also expressed in particular ways at this meeting a very deep concern about the war in Iraq, calling for a real movement, immediate movement toward a resolution in that war. We have called for, expressed concern about the situation in Burma, Myanmar, and so on. So there have been a number of resolutions that have passed that are very particularly important in these times.
As you say, you've been involved in the peace movement in your own country, the United States, for many, many years. Do you see really much hope on the horizon in being able to make the voice of organizations like your own heard at government level where the decisions are being taken?
That's a very difficult task. I think that for the last decades, the movement for peace and social justice in the United States has continued. But ours is a very big country, and political and economic decision makers based in the United States or working for the United States government have tremendous power. So the task is a long, slow one. But there are also good people working within the government and within the private sector who are allies, and I think slowly but surely we begin to make a difference. There has been, for example, significant shift in U.S. public opinion about the war in Iraq, and I think a increasing recognition of the injustice of that war and the tragedy that it's creating. So slowly we make a difference. We keep at it, and we try to be both faithful and effective, but at least faithful.
During this meeting, you've also been making a pilgrimage to the fields of Flanders, haven't you? Site of one of the terrible tragedies of the past century during the First World War. Tell us a bit about that.
Yes, we are part of a very important part of this gathering has been this pilgrimage that has brought us face to face with the reality of war, to stand in city or a town like Ypres, and to realize the devastation that happened here, to see rows and rows and rows of tombstones from young, mostly men, who died within just a few months in this part of Flanders, just brings back with such clarity the futility and tragedy of war. I had a very interesting conversation with Bishop Paride Taban from the Sudan, who is part of our assembly here. We were walking through one of the cemeteries together, and the bishop was reflecting on the ongoing tragedy in the Sudan and how, to me, the young soldiers, 17, 18, 19 years old, who were being remembered here, was such a sign of tragedy. And he was saying, well, in the Sudan, the children being drawn into war were 10 years old and 11 years old. And so the terrible tragedy of war goes on. And I think that it just is rekindling the commitment of all of us from Pax Christi International to end war once and for all.
It's particularly significant that you're making this pilgrimage on All Souls Day, of course.
Yes, it is. It's a very moving, and it's especially moving to be here with people from so many countries where All Souls Day brings back recent memories of both loved ones lost and of those who were killed in the pursuit of peace and justice. And so this morning in our Mass, we particularly remembered Archbishop Bosco Romero from El Salvador and the two Maryknoll sisters and Ursuline sister and lay worker from Cleveland who were killed in El Salvador, and named peace workers from all over the world who gave their lives for peace. So it is very meaningful to be here on this day.
And my thanks there to Marie Dennis, former head of the Maryknoll Office for Global Concerns and one of the new co-presidents of Pax Christi International. A new poll of people in over 20 different countries around the world shows that most are ready to make personal sacrifices to address the problems posed by climate change. The BBC poll released on Monday suggests 4/5 of the population is prepared to make important lifestyle changes, even in countries like the US and China, the world's two biggest emitters of carbon dioxide, believed to increase global warming. As concern about the effects of climate change becomes more widespread, organisations and individuals are stepping up efforts to try to lessen their so-called carbon footprint and change to sources of energy other than fossil fuels. My colleague Susie Hodges has been taking a closer look at ways in which the Vatican and the Catholic Church at large are playing their part in this endeavour.
Earlier this year, the Vatican hosted its first ever international conference on climate change, and it is also planning to become the world's first carbon neutral state. The Holy See said it had accepted an offer from a climate solutions company to plant a forest in Hungary, which will offset the Vatican's carbon dioxide emissions for 2007. Other green projects by the Vatican include a plan to install solar energy panels on the roof of the Paul VI auditorium, which is used for the papal general audiences. Pope Benedict has on a number of occasions urged Christians to take care of creation, saying lifestyle choices are damaging the environment and making the lives of poor people especially unbearable. In the US, a small number of Benedictine monasteries have been going green for a long time, and more religious orders are now joining the eco bandwagon by installing wind turbines to generate electricity on their properties. One of the pioneers in this regard is the Benedictine Sacred Heart Monastery, located at Richardson in the state of North Dakota. In 1997, the monastery installed two wind turbines to combat escalating electricity bills and protect the environment. Sister Paula Larson is the business manager at the monastery, and she told me how at the time there were many who opposed this decision.
We faced a lot of opposition, and I felt like I was pushing a rope uphill, but it turns out that we are the first people in North Dakota to have a commercial-sized wind turbine, and because of the success of our project, the wind industry has exploded and is expanding in our state.
Now, you said you faced a lot of opposition. From whom and why?
Opposition from our electrical generation company, because they didn't think it would work. Opposition from other utilities. Opposition from our persons that provide the energy for our heat.
What was the cost of the turbines, and what have been the savings made in terms of lower electricity bills over the past 10 years?
The cost of the turbines in the initial phase was $120,000, and we thought if we could save 25% a year on our electric bill that we'd pay them off in 10 years, and we far exceeded that. Our lowest production has been 25%, but our highest production has been over 50% of our electricity.
So it's already more than paid for itself?
That is correct.
So if you had to work out what you've saved over the past 10 years, have you got a figure there?
I would say that it would be close to between $175,000 and $200,000.
In 2006, a school in Rhode Island run by Benedictine monks gave the green light to a project to construct a wind turbine for generating electricity. Brother Joseph Byron, one of the monks at the Portsmouth Abbey School, was the mastermind behind this project, and he told me more about how it got off the ground.
It was my idea and a fellow who works with me, who's the director of operations. We run a prep school here, and costs were going through the roof, and people said we should be trying these kind of things, and so we decided just to go for it and see what we could come up with.
And did you face any opposition, or were people surprised at first by this decision?
Well, I guess people were surprised. One of the things in hindsight that we did right was that when we first started talking about this, I literally went door to door around the neighborhood and said, you know, people say we should be trying to do these things and we'd like to put one up and we know it's really big. What do you think? And so the neighbors were incredibly supportive of the whole thing, and so was the town. And that made a huge difference here.
Now, I know you've only had it in for a year, but have you got any idea what kind of savings you will make over the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, it's done incredibly well by us. We use about 2.6 million kilowatt hours a year for the school here and the monastery, and we saved about 40% of our total electric load by having the turbine up. So in the first year, when all was said and done, money we saved and money we earned from selling electricity, we earned about $200,000 into the school's budget last year. So if you just keep multiplying that year by year, and it'll do better as the price of electricity actually goes up. So it's done very well and has been very popular.
Both these projects have clearly reaped long-term benefits in terms of lower electricity bills and reduced emissions of fossil fuels. But as both Sister Paula and Brother Joseph explain, there are also theological and ethical issues underpinning their decision to turn to wind energy.
God asks us to walk gently on the earth, and also in Scripture it says that the wind blows where it wills. So we feel that the wind is part of God's creation for us to use to help in his work, and that's kind of how we explain it.
From our perspective here, right specifically here, we live in a really beautiful piece of property, and we've always thought of ourselves as being the stewards of this really beautiful place. And in general, that applies, you know, on a broader range, that we're all custodians and stewards of the place we live in, and we should be trying to take care of it and not abusing it. And so we're kind of putting our money where our mouth is and says, okay, well, here's a way to at least make a step at that one.
So apart from the wind turbines, are there any other ways in which the monks in Rhode Island are trying to preserve the environment and lessen their carbon footprint? Brother Joseph again.
The biggest thing we're doing is, I mean, in general, around the whole place, we're trying to conserve energy as much as we can. We've done a big program of converting to compact fluorescent lights, putting high-efficiency boilers in, motion sensor switches, water-saving devices, you name it. We also We just built a green dormitory for the school that has a big solar array for heat and hot water on the roof and all kinds of green things in it. So we're doing everything we can think of to try and do that.
Sister Paula believes that the Catholic Church is now doing a lot to promote greater awareness of environmental issues.
I think the Catholic Church is teaching on environment and supporting environmental efforts. It is greatly encouraged. And also, we have encouraged other Catholic facilities in our area to consider wind energy as a means of helping them to financially support themselves.
And, as Brother Joseph points out, we can all play our part in this endeavor to cut down on our carbon emissions.
The biggest thing that we all can do is just trying to conserve what we're using so that we're not kind of hogs and we're turning the lights off and we're trying to use as little electricity as we can and still do the right thing. So, yep, conservation is the biggest thing. And then if you've got space or you've got a big facility, then something like this or solar or geothermal, the other green energy sources should be looked into. They make sense from a financial point of view as well as from a green point of view.
And all the monks, the other monks, went along with this decision? There were no dissenters?
Well, I'm not sure that I would go quite that far. I was saying to folks in the town, my feeling was if I could convince my brethren to do this, I could probably convince anybody to do this. We tend to be a fairly conservative lot. And in fact, there's one funny story. One of the former abbot here, who's quite a funny guy, and in the course of this, he was not quite so keen about it. And somebody printed him up business cards that said MAP, and it was Monks Against Progress. And it was all rather tongue-in-cheek. But in the end, I think everybody's very happy that we've done this.
So are you now called the monks who've gone green? So, joking apart, these two monasteries' green credentials are now firmly established. And as Sister Paula reveals, other religious orders are now following their example. And she is proud that her monastery was one of the first to go green.
Other Benedictines are beginning to do this. We have a monastery in Missouri that is working with a utility and is going to put up a wind turbine on their property. And we have a steady stream of tourists and students who come here for educational programs and to understand how the turbines work.
Do you feel in some ways that you were trailblazers because you were going green long before it became more mainstream, shall we say?
Yes, I feel that we were trailblazers and we are recognized within our state exactly as you state, as trailblazers.
My thanks to Susie Hodges speaking there with Sister Paula Larson and Brother Joseph Byron. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.